Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We will, on the broadcast today, tell you things you didn't know about the job market. We'll play you some Appalachian fiddle music, and we'll end with Paris Hilton. I know. I'm sorry about that last one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 8th day of April, and we begin today with a somewhat off-the-beaten-path indicator of the health of the American labor market. From the good people at the U.S. Department of Labor this morning came a monthly report called, officially, the Job Opening and Labor Turnover Survey, JOLTS for short. From it, we learned that employers advertised 4.2 million jobs in February. For some context here, that's the highest number of job openings since January of 2008, which is to say right before the bottom fell out, as you remember. But as has happened all too often in the past, what, 4, 5, 6 years, if you dig a little bit deeper, things don't look quite as pretty, do they? Marketplace's Bree Benishore gets us up to speed on that one.
Remember that guy, that flight attendant who quit his job, cursed out the plane?
Slater then activated the plane's inflatable emergency chute, slid down to the tarmac, and ran away, but not before grabbing beer from the concession cart.
In a way, our economy would be better off if more of us were like him. Not the flipping people off part, but the willingness to leave your job.
When people are quite confident that they can get a better job offer, they are willing to quit jobs that they find unpleasant.
Gary Bertless is an economist with the Brookings Institution. He says economists watch how often people are quitting. It's called the quits rate, and it's super low right now, 1.9%, and it hasn't really changed in 3 years.
People look around and they don't see the prospect of improving their situation very much. They're hanging on to the job they have, which lessens pressure on employers to give their workers good pay increases.
And it is exactly the low-wage jobs that are coming online right now in those 4.2 million job postings. Waiters, bartenders, temp workers. And by the way, these are job postings. It doesn't necessarily mean that employers are hiring people to fill all those positions.
One job opening is less likely to translate into a hire than it was before the recession hit.
Heidi Scherholz is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. She says businesses still aren't seeing a ton of demand, so they don't need to hire someone right now. And
there are a lot of really desperate people out there, and there's a hope on the part of employers to get a really great worker for really cheap.
Which brings us back to why people aren't too hot to quit their job. Even if they find another one, they're not going to get much of a raise by switching. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you're looking for a job or thinking about quitting the one you have, let us know. We're collecting your stories. It's at our website, marketplace.org. All right, continuing with that general thread of jobs and who has them, there is a big brouhaha going on in tech. Google, Apple, Intel, and a bunch of others are wrapped up in a class action lawsuit. Employees are claiming the companies agreed not to poach talent from one another and that as a result, they, the workers, that is, are missing $9 billion in lost wages. Marketplace's Queen of Kim takes it from there.
Jim Balasone is with the Markula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. And he says figuring out exactly how much money in wages was lost, well, that's a lawyer's game. But he says the emails discovered during the lawsuit help us connect the dots.
An email exchange between Google and Apple where Google sought the approval of Apple to hire 4 French software engineers who had already left Apple.
Steve Jobs' response? Here's Balasone reading his email.
We'd strongly prefer that you not hire these guys, Steve.
And Google honored his wishes. There's a lost wages, but harder to measure, the lost opportunity. Balasone says having Google on your resume is a huge career boost. Steve Donnelly is the head of recruiting at Big Commerce, an e-commerce site. He's been reading the emails, too. He mentions one in which Google asked if it could hire a current Apple employee. And again, Apple says no. Donnelly says that leaves that employee exposed.
It limits the person that may end up staying with the company.
Scott Brosnan is a recruiter at Rookbridge in San Francisco, and he says competition for hiring engineers is stiff.
I've seen candidates in this market that a year and a half ago were at $80,000 on their base salary, And a year and a half later, they've changed, you know, two or three companies, and they're now at $140,000.
Brosnan says if engineers were blocked from taking jobs, then they were losing real money. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim from Marketplace.
No sooner did we do a story yesterday on the trials and tribulations of the NASDAQ and the tech sector than traders went ahead and made a fool of us. One of the perils of business journalism, I suppose. Up arrows all the way around on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is perhaps no single article of clothing so distinctly American as the blue jean. I, in point of fact, am wearing a pair right now. It is what you might call an established industry, which can make innovation a tricky thing. And that gets us to Josh Gustin and Stephen Powell. They're the founders of a year-old startup company in San Francisco called Gustin Jeans, and they are trying to change the way people buy jeans. Think online customers, crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, and on-demand inventory. Guys, it's good to have you both on.
Thanks for having us.
Josh, let me start with you since your name is on the company. This is, I think, denim is a $6 billion a year business. Not the most friendly of places for startups. Why'd you try to do this? Why are you doing this?
So this was something that I've had a long relationship with. So I actually got into denim.
Jeans,
about,
you mean?
Yes, very long. Almost 8 years ago, I was back at Cal getting my MBA, and everyone else was kind of going into consulting and banking. And I wanted to teach myself how to make the perfect pair of jeans.
Give me a sense of your life in retail before this. Why didn't it work for you, I guess, is my question.
The basic model of never knowing what consumers want to buy is the fundamental flaw in this model. So I would basically sit here and think, what do you, Kai, want to wear a year from now?
I don't know what I'm wearing tomorrow, man.
Exactly. So then I'd place a big bet on fabric and sew all these jeans and put them in a warehouse and then spend the next 12 months convincing you that that is indeed what you wanted to wear. And that just doesn't work. It's crazy.
And Stephen, you guys get into this business, and how do you fix that? What is this new process, system? I don't know, what do you call it?
We've got, you know, 6 to 15 campaigns running at any given time.
And a campaign, sorry, to be clear, a campaign is a clothing item.
A campaign is a clothing item.
Got
so
it.
One particular style of jeans or, you know, shirt, you back it. Once enough people back it, the campaign closes. We collect money and go into production, and it ships about 6 weeks later.
Sounds a lot like Kickstarter, Josh.
It is. We are the first fully crowdsourced fashion company.
The great thing we left out is that all of our stuff is priced at wholesale now. So where our jeans were $205 to $269 at retail, they start at $81.
All right. So if they're not paying $225 at retail, plus or minus, and they're paying, what, $100 through you guys, plus or minus, what has this done to your margins, Josh?
It actually hasn't changed them at all. So we used to sell to boutiques in San Francisco and LA and New York for $81, and they would mark it up to $205. So
wow.
Everyone kind of wins. And that's kind of what's cool about the model. Since we don't have to take big risk on a particular type of fabric, we can offer a lot more variety. So we've probably used over 100 different denims in less than a year. That's probably what another fashion brand would use in a decade.
It's a little bit supply and demand, right?
It's exactly that.
Yeah.
So we line up supply and demand every single time. And this is something fashion never does.
Josh, are you guys in the black yet?
Oh, yeah. We were from the day we relaunched under this model.
Is anybody else jumping on this with you guys? I mean, do you have competition in this space?
No. I think a lot of people have been looking at us, but no one has really come after us yet.
Not yet. Not yet. That's the key phrase, right?
It is. I think we benefit a little bit from how old this industry is, and a lot of fashion companies are used to working a certain way.
Right.
And either they're too wedded to the traditional retail model, so they can't walk away from hundreds and hundreds of stores. That's too scary. Or they just don't get it. And they're like, no, we've always done business this way. Why would we ever change?
Josh Gustin and Stephen Powell, they are the co-founders of Gustin Jeans. Thanks very much, you guys. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're a week or so away from Passover, and if you know anything about that particular Jewish holiday, you likely know it involves matzahs, the unleavened crackers you can buy in your local grocery store, usually in that one aisle with all the ethnic foods in it. The kosher section of most supermarkets is dominated by Manischewitz, which as of today is owned by the private equity firm Bain Capital. The company wants to expand beyond that kosher aisle, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
When you hear the word Manischewitz, you probably think of the super sweet kosher wine.
Has a kind of nutty taste, has a kind of gentle taste.
This is Sammy Davis Jr. in a Manischewitz wine ad from the 1960s. But before we go any further, I should point out that the Manischewitz Wine Company is different from the one that sells kosher foods in bright orange packaging. But both companies have tried in the past to market their products to the general public.
Try some after dinner tonight. It's delicious.
In the current effort, Manischewitz wants people to think of the kosher symbol, that little letter K on food packaging, in the same way they think of the fair trade symbol or the USDA organic symbol, higher quality and healthier.
People want to know, you know, where the stuff comes from, how it's made, who's making it.
David Bernard is a marketing strategist with Mythmakers. Many of their clients are brands you would find in Whole Foods, like Odwalla. Mythmakers' strategy is to turn brands into compelling stories about the essential human truth or core beliefs that brought the company to life. A strategy that seems tailor-made to kosher food, which, according to Jewish belief, is approved by God.
Yeah, I don't think you have to go to approved by God, you know, but that's pretty strong endorsement. But I think, again, what it gets down to is it gets down to this idea of authenticity. It's like the people behind this product really care about what goes into it.
Scott Meadow has been in the private equity business for decades. He says what Bain Capital brings to the deal is a high degree of skill when it comes to analyzing all the data surrounding kosher food sales and marketing budgets.
And I'm sure they have a model that shows the company, you know, dipping in terms of cash flow because they're going to be investing in the marketing plan.
Meadow says that even with Bain's track record, getting people to pick up matzah instead of Fritos is going to be a challenge. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up,
I tend to have a very positive opinion of Paris Hilton.
I know. I already said I'm sorry, okay? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 10 points today, not quite the 10th percent, closed at 16,256. The NASDAQ up 33 points, 8-tenths percent, 41.12 there. The S&P 500 rose 6 points, about 4-tenths percent, ended things at 1851. Tech stocks put a stop to the beating they've taken the past couple of days. Shares in LinkedIn traded up almost 6%. Amazon rose almost 3%. Yahoo was up 2.3%. Comcast kicked off the regulatory review of its planned merger with Time Warner Cable with a 175-page filing to the FCC. Comcast says consumers won't be hurt by the deal and says the new company will be better able to compete with Google and Apple when it comes to video. All right. Comcast shares off about 0.5% on the day, by the way. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses international cooperation and space exploration at a hearing titled From Here to Mars. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee holds a hearing on travel closer to the ground, assessing railway safety. And someone who hates their name must have come up with this one. It's National Name Yourself Day. Just for a day, people. You turn into a pumpkin at midnight. I'm Michelle Phillippe, but tomorrow call me Beatrice.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Coal was, not all that long ago, king in this country, but a natural gas boom and new rules on the environment are pushing coal out of the electricity market. It's a transition to natural gas and renewables that is generally good for the planet, but one that comes with costs, human costs. Sarah Gardner from our sustainability desk went to Central Appalachia, where coal has been especially hard hit and where people are starting to contemplate a future without it. Here she is.
If you want to make a fool of yourself in eastern Kentucky, ask people if they have any coal miners in their family.
Father was a coal miner. My uncles were coal miners.
All my uncles, everyone in my husband's family.
All my grandfathers and my grandfather-in-law and my father-in-law and my husband.
My uncles have done it, and I guess it's just in my blood.
Coal is eastern Kentucky, or at least it has been for the last century, which is part of the problem. They've already mined the thickest coal beds.
It's just the coal seams. They're getting smaller.
Smaller and harder to get at, says underground miner Ryan Trent.
So the more rock you cut, less coal you're getting, which is less money you're making.
which is why Appalachian coal is having a hard time competing, not just against natural gas, but against newer, more efficient coal mines. Throw in stricter regulations on strip mining, and you've got production slowdowns, mine closures, and 15% unemployment. That statistic includes Trent, who's been out of work for over a year.
And I've jokingly talked about my other buddies that's been laid off in the mines that I got the softest hands in Eastern Kentucky now from doing so many dishes.
Trent and other miners are used to the ups and downs of the coal business, but Justin Maxson, president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, says this time feels different.
It is different. I mean, I think to lose almost 7,000 jobs in 18 months is a catastrophe. It's a huge economic collapse. Folks, to some degree, feel like they're under cultural assault.
The realization that this could be a permanent decline in what's been the lifeblood of the region is just now beginning to settle in after years of warnings and, some would say, denial. On a Thursday evening at a tattoo parlor in Letcher County, owner John Haywood and his friends are playing music and talking coal.
I can remember my dad when I was a young boy saying, oh, there's only so many more years in coal. And people have been saying that for, I feel like, ever since I was little, and I'm 36 now.
Haywood's coal mining customers, they were among the best paid workers in the county, even without unions, $65,000, even $80,000 a year with good benefits, in a place where the poverty rate is close to 30%. But those guys, they don't show up much anymore.
They used to come in once a month, even twice a month. You know, tattoo collectors, they're willing to sit for a long time and get covered up.
I was born and raised in the mouth of a hazard holler, with the coal cars roaring and a rumbling by my door. And now they sit in a rusted row of empties, and the L&N don't stop here no more.
People here may be mourning coal's decline, but that doesn't mean they've found something to replace it. In fact, they've barely begun. Some blame the slow start on all the war on coal rhetoric. They say it's distracted coal towns from finding alternatives. Others say politicians have misspent coal severance taxes, money intended for economic diversification. At a roundtable of regional leaders in the mining town of Hazard, I popped the question. The question is, what's the alternative? What's going to replace coal? Does anybody have any good ideas? Insert long pause here. But that's because I was asking the wrong question, somebody told me. No one thing can ever replace the coal economy, he said. Besides, this isolated mountainous region first has to get more four-lane highways and better cell and internet service. The feds and the state have targeted the area for special assistance, but as of yet, there's no regional strategy. Jeff Whitehead runs a jobs program here that started during Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. He says Eastern Kentucky needs a bailout.
In every other industry, whether it be farming, auto industry, I mean, what happened in Detroit when that industry was threatened? There was a lot of government support, lots of it.
Some out-of-work miners here have left to take coal mining jobs in other parts of the country, but others like Jeff Combs love Appalachia more than mining, and they're willing to do local jobs at lower wages. Combs is training to be an ambulance EMT.
Well, for me, I'm just a hillbilly and have friends in just about every county around. And all the families here, and you know, when you want to get together, it's it. You don't have to travel hundreds of miles. Yeah, just deep roots.
So deep-rooted, East Kentuckians joke about it. At a shop where they make dulcimers, craftsman Mike Sloan, in true Appalachian tradition, explains with a story.
This guy dies on a Friday afternoon, and he goes to heaven.
St. Peter shows him around, says Sloan. There's one group playing harps, another picking flowers, and then they stumble onto a group of prisoners.
People are chained to the walls, and they're screaming and crying and everything, and the guy is really perplexed. This is heaven. You know, and he says, what's going on here? And St. Peter said, oh, that's the people from Eastern Kentucky. They still want to go home every weekend.
In Eastern Kentucky, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The music in Sarah's piece that you're hearing right now was performed for us by Kentucky musicians Lee Sexton, Brett Ratliff, and John Haywood. We've got more of it
and a slideshow of where Sarah went when she was out reporting this piece, all at marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow, Stephen Beard takes us to an English village that lost its coal mine some 30 years ago. There's a not all that long list of names, families, really, that sort of epitomized American business and industry of the 20th and, to some degree, the 21st century. Ford, Rockefeller, Walton of Walmart fame, of course. And what about Hilton? I'm not talking Paris, but we will get there sooner rather than later, I promise. The Hilton brand started out in San Antonio, New Mexico. The kid everybody called Connie, and eventually became one of the biggest hotel chains on the planet. Randy Tarabarelli tells the story of the Hilton family from Conrad to his kin in his new book, The Hiltons. Randy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
One hates to judge a book by its cover, and I won't because we're going to have a long conversation about it. But on the cover of this book about Conrad Hilton is, of course, Mr. Hilton himself, Zsa Zsa Gabor, his wife, his son, Nikki, and his wife, Elizabeth Taylor, and, of course, Paris. How much? It's quite a way to start.
Anytime you can get Elizabeth Taylor and Zsa Zsa Gabor and Paris Hilton on the cover of a book, that's interesting. And, of course, all of those people are key players in the story. But Conrad Hilton is obviously the center focus in this book and the empire that he built.
He starts literally in his father's general store.
That's right, exactly. He was a kid. He was about 19 years old working for his father, and they had just experienced the stock market crash in 1902.
Yeah.
And they were looking for ways to make money. And Conrad said, why don't we rent out a couple of the rooms in this general store, which is where they also happened to live.
Yeah, I mean, we should say it was like a 10-room house,
it was
right?
A
10-room
house.
Kept building out. They had eight kids, and exactly. Everybody had their own room, right?
Yeah, so they rented out these rooms at $2 a room. His mother cooked the meals. His sister cleaned the rooms. He was responsible for the baggage. And that was really his first foray into the hotel business.
Yeah, and he tries a couple of things, right? He tries his hand at various businesses and then eventually goes back to this hotel idea.
Yes.
Makes it pretty well, and then comes the Great Depression, which I think, you know, my read of it is that that's when he proved his mettle as a hotelier and a businessman, yeah?
Yes. You know, Conrad Hilton came up during a period of time when most people felt that America was never going to be able to recover. And he had this optimism about him, and he had a code, a moral code, where he would not declare bankruptcy.
You tell actually a great story of how he kept these hotels during the Depression, when nobody was traveling, nobody needed hotel rooms. And he goes and scrapes and borrows like $500 from a bellman or something, right?
Yeah, there was a bellboy who actually said, you know, I'll give you $500 because I really believe in you. And he took the $500, and that bellboy ended up profiting on dividends in Hilton Hotel stock for the rest of his life. People who helped Conrad Hilton out when he was young and struggling stayed with him. Many of them ended up on his board of directors.
Huh.
And I think that that's really a big part of his success is the fact that he wasn't a shark.
Visionary is a strong word, but when we started traveling as a population, he knew that we would want American-style hotels overseas. And so he said, you know what? I'm going out and I'm going to build these hotels overseas.
That's true. He felt that commerce overseas only benefited America's economy. You know, as Americans went overseas, they began to Americanize, many of the cities that they went to just by virtue of their presence.
Yeah. Is it true that he put his autobiography in bedside drawers of Hilton's all over the world? Is that?
That's true. I mean, his autobiography of 1957, which was called Be My Guest, was in every bedstand, along with the Bible.
Beginning of Bible. Now, was that him, too?
That was him, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Speaking of, by the way, the Hilton family cannot let you get out of here without asking you what he would think today of what that family has become with Paris and all the rest.
Well, I know that, you know, the family mandate is this. You can do anything you want to do with the Hilton name except go into the hotel business.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I met probably 50 Hiltons, none of whom we have ever heard of. Whatever you think about Paris Hilton, you have to admit she built her own empire and made $50 million doing so.
It is a book called The Hiltons, The True Story of an American Dynasty, and we have gone from Conrad to Paris. Randy Tarabarelli is the author. Randy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which I think, honestly, the internet has taken things one step too far. On Slate today, after browsing through our very own Chrissy Clark's amazing series on food stamps, which you really ought to check out, I saw this. You can now search the online review site Yelp using emojis, those little cartoonish characters you can create with a certain set of keystrokes. So you search on a pair of scissors, you get listings for hair salons, a high heel gets you shoe stores, you get the picture. I, however, do not even want to think about what happens if you search on a smiley face or a wink or any of that stuff. I'm just not going there. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this, Tuesday. Today, the Dow bumped up 10 points, not quite a 10%. The NASDAQ up 33 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 up 6 points, about 0.4%. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Caitlin Esch works on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shea Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.